Accession number 10165, reel number 14.
Martin McLean, reel 14. You were telling me about how the tables are sorted out in the barrack room.
Yes, I spoke there in a previous tape about burnishes, the thing that the hussars wear on the shoulder, like a chain mail. We didn't get these off the hussars. We had to go and buy them from the Naffy. And it was part of every soldier's kit, more or less them days, for polishing his bayonet. So we polished the table ends with this. Well, Pat had decided to polish the tables. So he got some stain and stained the woodwork. He must have had knowledge of woodwork. And then he bought some Johnson's floor polish, a light-coloured tan stuff, and polished the table. And it was so outstandingly beautiful and so good that we all adopted it. Well, part of my job now is to get the two tables in our barrack room up the same standard with caustic soda and what have you. And then from there on, it followed up that we start polishing the floors instead of scrubbing them. And then apart from that, we used to paint the barrack room. It wasn't our job, we know this. But to get a high standard of efficiency for inspections and things, we wanted to relieve the drabness of the barrack rooms. And if you've got to imagine a huge barrack room, about a length of this block, about 15 yards long, and two of them joined together, and high about, I'd say, about 12 feet high. We didn't used to paint the top of the building, but up to about shoulder level, we used to paint a dark green with a black border on, right around the barrack room. And the men used to buy this paint, by the way. All the troops in the barrack room chipped in to buy this paint. And this was not done through a fund, by the way. It was done through, the money would be given to the sergeant or the corporal. The corporal, in turn, would have to go off down to Woolworths to buy the paint, which was quite a big place them days. At sixpence a tin, or sixpence where it was, obtain a receipt for rebirth and show the sergeants what he'd done with the money and keep an account of all the little bit monies that were received in this manner. For instance, all the men wanted towels because, as I said, in the kit inspections, they had a special towel, so we bought towels from Woolworths, lovely white things, sixpence. Went down, bought them again, receipts again, money again, accounting to the sergeant. There's no fiddles because my religion would never allow me to fiddle. My own principles, the way I was brought up as a child, would never allow me to fiddle. So the men got a fair deal on this scheme, but the men had to pay for it. So that was more or less the life of a lance corporal, sleeping in the barrack room, ensuring discipline, ensuring no fights, ensuring economy of interior decoration and everything, interior economy, you call it, of the squad. And then, in turn, when the squad went on parade, going out with the squad on parade as well. Every time they went out in and wet and train. Another part of my job was to march the boys to school, the men. The school was at the far end of the barracks, as with the regimental tailor. And I used to march the men over there, and it was the only opportunity a lance corporal ever got of putting his training cadre drill into practice, apart from being with a battalion. And so when you had the squad, say 40 men, you march them across they had to march all over. They weren't allowed to gaggle across or wander off on their own, because you had the Northumberland Fusiliers, and you had the on the other side of the barracks, you had the Royal Artillery, and you had our own. So there's three units in the barracks, and you couldn't have squads of men wandering around where officers were concerned. They had to be marched over for discipline and tidiness of the barracks. So that was Lance Corporal's job, take them over to school, take them on mental dental inspections and medicals, all that sort of thing. Well, this entailed marching across the square and marching at quite some distance, so this was my opportunity. And I used to drill the squad as we marched across the square, forming to deep from fours, changing step on the march, formation drill, change direction right form, left form, about turn, and all this sort of drill, that elementary drill while on the march, as we call it. And I used to get a lot of practice in this, and I enjoyed it, and so did the men, because it got the men up to a standard whereby they were getting more practice in for their final passing out tests and company commanders' inspections and tests partway through their recruits' training. And it got them foot sure. In other words, we had systems of check 1, 2, 3, 4. When we changed from 4 to 2s and 2s to 4, and then we had another check pieces and change of steps when we'd done the formula of line. Well, the men used to learn all this and they had it so they could pop, 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 and away. No bother. Anyway, unknowns to me, the command officer used to stand and watch us. And I didn't realise this till months, well, quite some time later. And I used to enjoy marching the men at school and the medical inspection team and then take them dental. They didn't take so many for the dental inspection. You'd take a few over. And then you could see where the men had come from the depot, from the, what squad they'd come from. As I told you in the, at the recruits, by the blood on the square and on the road, as they squirt the blood out the mouth from the dental treatment they'd received off the dental officer. And so I had a good initiation and drill in that manner. So the company commander, not the company commander, the sergeant in charge, took the men on drills, took them out and handed them over to a training cadre for weapon training instruction. He would take their elementary weapon training instruction, but for the more detailed stuff, like bayonet fighting, like movement and advance with the rifle, would then be done by a permanent staff of NCO's training cadre. It was on one of these inspections by the company commander where he does a preliminary inspection prior to the command officer's inspection prior to the passing out parade. In other words, they're checking to see if the platoon of men are receiving the right sort of training and if they're reaching the right stage of efficiency. And of course, by this would shed some as unlikely to become efficient soldiers. It was at one time during this training that it was noted that my company, my squad of men, had chicken pox. That was a big blunder, that. But anyway, it cannot be avoided. Somebody had chicken pox. So the whole squad was put in isolation in a different barrack room altogether near the cookhouse, where they had their meals handed through a window from the cookhouse, where no one was allowed out unless I took them out across the moor for a walk or a run, where they done the only training they done was with me in the barrack room, and were there for 10 days. And this is because we're all put in isolation. And them days, if a plague or of that nature or smallpox of anything hit you, it used to sweep through a unit like a wind. So they had to, once they got a plague of the sort, the inoculations weren't so good as they are today. When a man got like measles or, as I say, chicken pox or smallpox, there was no doubt about they were in isolation for a long time. Well, we were in isolation for about 12 days, and these lads just about drove me scatty. They wanted out, they couldn't get out. The little bits of petty quibbles. We had one lad, a lad called Day, who was discharged as a misfit. He was hysterical, and the lads used to rib him. And I used to have to quell the fights with this particular lad, not only when we're in isolation, but in the barrack room as well. And of course, I had to put a report in about him, and the sergeant major and the sergeant had noted that he wasn't the right type. And he got berserk once. He put his bayonet on his rifle and he went charging at the lads. So I shouted and he come charging at me with his bayonet on. And I'm not boasting, but we were taught how to use, defend off with our hands on bayonets like they do with one-arm combat these days. And I just fended him off with the elbow and the bayonet went across my shoulder and I took it off him and put him in a house arrest. And he eventually went, and after we came out of isolation, he went into the guard room and he was given a court-martial and discharged the army. But the lads were getting on top of each other's nerves because we couldn't do the PT, we couldn't get into the canteen. We were stuck in this barroom for 12 days and I was pleased it was all over and we got back to normality. That was, it always impressed my mind, that young lad there. I was sorry for him, just the maybe being enclosed for the space of time, had got on top of him, and he was discharged from the army. As a matter of fact, I have in my cupboard now a little box, a little, like a wooden attache case that he gave me before he left. He says, there you are, that's for you. And I use it for my medical kit now. I've had it from them days. It's one of the few things I've got left of me old army days through the wars and things, lost in so much stuff, and it's in my house now.
Did you get promoted to corporal while you were at the depot?
Well, I must tell you how that is up now. Average time of waiting for a lance corporal to be made up to full corporal was an average 2 years or more, at the least 2 years. I was now a lance corporal of about a year, I'd say, maybe a bit more, I can't exactly remember. And I was telling you that these inspections and parades by the company commander and by the commanding officer, whereby they passed the men out. Well, we all assembled spick and span on the square, company commanders included, and the company sergeant major, the depot company sergeant major, everybody concerned, and the RSM for the CO's inspection and the CO's passing out parade. They called the command officer, Charlie V.A. We call him Charlie, he didn't know it, but we knew his Christian name, Charlie V.A. He was next machine gun battalion officer, First War. Smart type of man, very smart, very strict on discipline. His name was, we used to call him Y.I. because he spelled his name W-E-I-G-H-E. So we used to give him a dot, Charlie Y.I. He came on the square, and the sergeant called the men up to attention, and they'd done a bit of weapon training under the training carder, being at fence and whatever. No, sorry, they'd done that afterwards. Drill is the first part. He said, the sergeant, he says, right, you stand down, sergeant. I want the lance corporal to drill the squad. Well, this was a shocker, because this had never happened before. The sergeant always drilled the squad for the company commanders and passing out parade. The corporal wasn't even allowed to drill him unless the sergeant was ill. So I had to step forward and take the squad on every conceivable type of drill that the infantryman is taught. But fortunately, as I said before, I knew my drill. I'd learnt it by being on the square with the sergeant. I knew all the words of command, and I was able to drill the squad with apparently excellent efficiency. I didn't say that at the time. I always thought there was some lacking in my drill. Maybe that's just self-opinionated, but apparently I'd done a good job with it, because there was no faults with the squad. They'd done the drill well. But mind, I'll say this for a squad as well. They were so well drilled, you'll give the word of command the wrong foot, they'll carry on, they hit the right foot, and they'll do it properly. The CO might have known that, but they'd do it properly. And you do all the foot drill without weapons, and they march the men back onto the ground arms, which are rifles lying on the ground. You've got to march them exactly onto the rifles again, halt them, take up arms, slope arms, and then carry on marching about the square with their weapons, with their rifles, presenting arms on the march, whilst on the march, whereby they have a system whereby you bring the rifle down on the arm, take your band off, stick it on, and then they halt on a certain number of paces, and then you come to present, and then marching. All these sort of things we used to do, and I had to take the men on this. And I thought I'd done fairly well, but I was told by the sergeant major later on that I'd done an excellent job. And, a short while afterwards, I got accelerated promotion. I was sent back to the battalion as a full corporal, which a feather in my cap. People congratulated me, and they couldn't understand how I got accelerated promotion, but there we are, doing a bit of drill across the square in front of the CO, and I didn't know who was watching, and him enforced me to do this drill parade. And he also had been watching me on weapon training as well, because he used to take the men on weapon training. Give you one particular instance. I had to take field training, advancing across ground with the bayonet. Now, this is done in two phases of the old infantry training book. One was you teach the men how to draw the line down fighting, put the safety catch on, lie the rifle down by the side, and get ready to get up and run and then get on again without damaging the rifle, without damaging themselves, and lay on the ground. And bring the rifle up and start firing again at practice rounds, you know. The command officer apparently was watching us one day, and I took this class on the parade ground on the square. And the CO was raving mad about it. He asked over the telephone the company commander, "Who is that lunatic sort of style taking these men on across the square on open drill and advance and fire movement when there's cover on the right there, grass and cover and trenches and everything which it made?" So as soon as the squad's dismissed, there's a company sergeant major waiting upstairs. The company commander's raving mad about you. Up I go. "Why are you taking the men on the drill on the square when there's cover there available?" The command officer's up in an uproar about it. And we've looked and we've had a look at the training syllabus, and it tells you advance and movement. I said, because if you had read the book, if you don't mind me saying so, it says, under no circumstances will you use cover for the first initial lesson. You will train the men on an open barrack square where they can get the hang of getting up and advancing without the use of cover. There's a lot of hush. Even the sergeant major hadn't realised this. And so when they picked up the phone and told the CO, everything went hush, all was forgiven. But before I went in there, well, after my blood, I was nearly down to private soldier, but somebody had slipped. They didn't know. They hadn't read the book up. So I got away with it. Maybe them things helped to get me accelerated promoting, but I went back to battalion.
You were at the Fenham for about 6 months then, I believe.
6 or 7 months, yes.
Now, you went back to the 1st Battalion. Which company did you go to and which platoon?
I went back to C Company.
Your old company?
My old company, yes. And then, you know, something I forgot to mention, and it was an interesting part of training, you see. When you talk like this, you're liable to jump and miss things out, which is an interest to people. The whole battalion had to learn how to drive vehicles when I was a scout company. A section commander such as myself, which I was before I went to the depot, I had the command of two Austin 7 cars and a motorcycle orderly. The car had little signs that we used to place on the front of it and the back of it when we were doing demonstrations. This is an armoured car. This car can reverse as quickly forward as it goes. Reverse as quick as it can go forward. It has reversible gears. The driver can turn around and face the other way and drive backwards as quick as it can go forwards. It's equipped with a Bren gun, an anti-tank weapon and all this. Actually, it was only somebody's ideas of what a scout car should be, which eventually they did do. And it was a little Austin car, an ordinary civilian Austin car, done up in khaki. That was our section. Well, everyone had learned to drive. Everyone was, a lot of men of the horse transport, got rid of horses now, except a few for the CO's hunters and for their sports and riding thing, were sent off on MT courses to Feltham and in Middlesex, which is the Army MT school in them days, and they were taught all mechanics, and in the short time they were there, how to drive, how to look after vehicles, maintain them, or what have you, and then the intern had to come back and teach the battalion how to drive. We received hordes and hordes of new lorries, new 1,500 weights for platoon stores, new Austin cars, new motorbikes, you name it, we had them. But A Company stayed the same with their old Carden Lloyd tanks. But they took one platoon of the anti-tank platoons, Carden Lloyds off them, because they were past redemption, they were breaking down every time they moved. And the blue smoke used to come off them when they drove along the road. Well, they were First World War vehicles. They were finished. And they gave them four beautiful Humber cars. When the four men that were on the tank platoon sat back in there, they were like the king passing, because only the king had a car like them days. Beautiful saloon cars with a canopy on the top for going over when it was raining. And they're sitting there with their sparkling equipment on, driving around the countryside, weighing an anti-tank platoon. And that was their role in life. But they really enjoyed it. All them cars, incidentally, were eventually taken off and given to commanding officers of units when they disbanded us as a scout, on our other role, because the battalion was not due to go overseas. Well, anyway, we had to do some driving instruction, and I had learned to drive, as with everybody else, knew nothing about driving, and Lance Corporal Hardy had to take me on driving, and off we went, take me on a car, take us on Chobham Ridges, which is in Blackdown, and we used to drive back and forward along these, not me, but lots of cars, driving back along these ridges, sandy ridges, learning to change up and change down, because all double declutching. And when he thought we're proficient, he'd take us on the roads and train us on the roads, teach us how to stop it, you know, like you do in any driving instruction. And then when we got more advanced, we'd wander off. This is beautiful to me. I thought Surrey was a marvellous part of the country. We'd go off to Epsom, to Windsor, to Leatherhead, along nearly into London. There was no sort of fixed route for us to do. The driver could just take you where you wanted, and he'd let you drive until he wanted to be drive, and so there'd be another, the two cars would be together, two instructors with the two men driving. It was beautiful, so lovely, lovely Surrey. And then eventually We had to go for a driving test with the captain of the MT, and he took me off to Camberley. He was going to go to the bank to draw money, and he took us on the same route as he takes all of them. And lo and behold, I got a first-class driver certificate because I didn't change down. I didn't stall my engine on this very steep hairpin bend that he took us up. I changed down to second because the little Austin car, although light, it couldn't have taken it unless unless I got down to third. But I was so confident with this car that I changed down to third and managed this hill, no bother at all, where others chuffed it up and the car stopped and, jerking up, or it stopped the car altogether. Some pass, but it was on orders. Lance Corporal Len McLean passed out as a first-class driver, and then he quotes the others, third-class drivers, second-class drivers.
And that was before you went to Fenham then, while you were still
that was before Corporal. I went to Fenham, yes.
But this driving, this was because you'd been changed to the...
Scout Company.
What other... Did you have any other special training as a scout company?
No, that was... we just were armed then with a Bren gun. Well, we got rid of the Vickers machine guns. We now had guns, the new Bren guns coming in. We didn't know much about them.
Did you get any training in Bren?
Yes, we were masters of them at the finish. You see, infantry, let's put it this way, you didn't get a piece of weaponry given you. You had to master it. And you were given the opportunity by both teaching and your own handling and the method in which they give you the shooting practice to become a master of that particular weapon. We became masters of it. So we didn't carry much weaponry on the scout course thing we were, because we only had boards to stick up. This gun, this anti-tank gun carries an anti-tank gun, a machine gun, and this, that, and the other. So we're just driving around, lovely, in the countryside, fair enough. We're down in the New Forest. This is a thing I must repeat, because this is one of the foolhardy things of my life. But down the New Forest, and the Major Percy was in my company commander, and he got us all together in this New Forest clearing. He says, "Now, little Danhill, I think they called the place." He says, "Now, you're going out today, and you're going out on a challenge. The Hussars, who are equipped in the same manner as you, only they have Rolls Royce and Daimler armoured cars, which are proper armoured cars. You're going out to challenge them in a bit of a competition to see if you can spot them first and if they can spot you first. They'd be hidden away to make you observant." And he says it's an exercise on your observation on all the things you've been taught. In other words, moving the cars at bounds, so that one's there so it can be shot at and the other one's behind. The motorcycle only to carry messages back to HQ if there's any run into anything serious. And I went up the hill, and there's this armoured car. I see its gun poking through the trees, the bushes at the top. And them days, it was a little game we used to play with each other. If you were captured, it was a bit of a disgrace to you. You were captured and kept in the enemy lines, and the exercise was over. And sometimes we wore blue bands around our hat to indicate what we were, or white, enemy, good people. We were good people always attacking the enemy. And these armoured cars, we saw them, and he started rolling towards us to capture us. I turned the Austin around. Now, I'm jumping the gun here. When the company commander was briefing us, he says, "Now, I want you to drive with care today, because this is autumn, and the leaves are on the ground, and it's been raining, and it's liable to make the roads slippy, and the car may get into a slip, so be careful." But me, first class driver, big head, as with all youngsters, this armoured car starts chasing us, and I had a passenger with us called Edwards. He was the machine gunner. And this, I turned the car around, and in my excitement, I put my foot on the accelerator, shooting down the hill. We had our boots full of studs and the heel plates and the whole lot, And the pedals of the vehicle were metal. A big lesson was learned from this, by the way. And come down this hill, and I could take the hill quite easy, no bother at all, at the speed I was doing. I was in excessive speed, and I put my brake on, a bit sharp maybe, but my foot, when I took the bend, shot off the steel with the studs on the accelerator and shot the speed up, and the car took the bend and bumped. We'd done 3.5 somersaults in the car. You can imagine an Austin car with an ordinary canvas canopy folded back. I hung on the wheel and hung on for dear life, The car was turning, ripping and smashing to pieces. And the other lad, Edwards, had been flung out in the first turn. And he had a slight sprain on the knee. He was a very lucky man. And I came to rest with the petrol coming out the gravity tank. It didn't have the pumps and everything to drive motors them days. They had a gravity-fed petrol. The petrol was leaking onto us, and so was the oil coming onto us on the car, and I scrambled out. I had a burst of my way out because the car was upside down on top of us. And I got out and licking me bruises and wondering what had happened to us. And there was nothing wrong with us. I shouldn't already been dead. I didn't even have a broken bone. This lad come up. He says, "What the hell you done there, Martin?" I'd turned the car over 3.5 times. I didn't know this at the time. Till the breakdown team came and had a look at it. The car's wheels were ripped off. The canopy was ripped off. And they wondered how I lived in it. And both of us got out alive. Well, I was put on a charge for all this. And I was taken up before the commanding officer. And the commanding officer was Churchill at the time, I think. Yes, Churchill. He says, "You know, this is a very silly thing you've done." He says, "This is the first serious accident we've had in the battalion. But fortunately, nobody's been hurt in the incident." He says, "We've heard your explanation about your studs slipping off on the accelerator. And that we do agree that it does happen. It can happen. Will be remedied," he said, "immediately. I give you a fine a pound. Car write-off." I mean, the car's only cost about £36 them days. Right off the car, I got fined a pound, which stayed on my regimental conduct sheet right to the day I was discharged from the army. A fine or a severe reprimand stood on your conduct sheet right throughout. And he says, "Part of your punishment is this. You'll go around all learner classes, all classes under instruction of driving, or anyone assembles of any sort or description on driving. You will go and lecture them about your foolhardiness and the way you drove and the way you caused an accident and how lucky you were to get away with it. And you might add how lucky you were to get away with from me also." He says, "But that's your job and that's what I had to do." No, the outcome of it was everybody had to immediately take their boots to the cobblers in by platoons, get all the studs taken out that was on driving, and they filled the holes with matchsticks or wood, so that a similar event wouldn't happen again. And so a little outcome of it, a little lesson learned, they realised that the steel studs jammed on it, accelerated the slip off. And that was the cause of the accident.
How were you actually trained in the Bren?
Once again, we were taken away on a training car, a young junior NCOs, and given a good grounding in the use of it by somebody who'd been away to Hythe on a small arms course. And then we, in turn, came back and instructed the men.
What did you think of it?
I thought it was a wonderful weapon. I liked the Bren gun. Not the Bren gun, the Lewis gun. The Lewis gun had a spread shot. No matter how accurate you were, finally 300 yards, you couldn't hit the bull all the time. It was so made the shots would splay around, which was giving a bigger cone of fire, which was maybe what they aimed at. It's the same with the Vickers machine gun. It gave a cone of fire, splitting out from different ways and different lengths and different shortnesses. Same with the Lewis gun. It gave a wider zone and it had more stoppages. And again, it was a cumbersome thing to carry around, but you got to use them. As compared to the Bren gun, a nice, neat, sharp gun, magazine loaded. The magazine used to hold 30 rounds. And you could go and put your shots on a target. For instance, we became so skilled at this, I was going to say we, but I've talked too much about myself. A lot of us became so skilled with it. We could take the 30 rounds in the magazine on a 30 yards range or on an open range and put all the rounds in the same hole, firing at single rounds, buff, 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 buff. The gun had such a lovely return action. When it fired, the working parts came back. So nice and soft. They could hold your gun and just pick up the rhythm of the gun and just pip, 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 and put all the rounds in the same place. We thought it was a marvellous gun. It was it was less cumbersome than a Lewis gun.
What about stoppages?
It was the magazines were easier to carry, and the stoppages were very simple. I'll be talking more about stoppages of the Bren gun, which in actual action on an incident in the Arakan. But the stoppages were very small with the Lewis gun. And the name Bren came from the man Bruvo, who was a Czechoslovakian that invented the gun, and Enfield, again, was for Enfield, the manufacturers of the gun. That's a little bit of the history that we were taught.